The following presentation is brought to you by Rita, the Rudyard Institute for Transpersonal Activity, a nonprofit public benefit corporation dedicated to disseminating the work and essential message of Dane Rudyard. All material is copyrighted by Layla Rudyard Hill. If you'd like to learn more about Rita or make a donation towards supporting the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardaudioarchives.com. We hope you enjoy the following presentation of The Philosophy of Cyclic Activity by Dane Rudyard. This is part two of a talk recorded in 1961. Part one was not recorded. It is 41 minutes long.
Well, let's take in a little different way what you might call the basic point of this approach. What we find there, whenever you deal with existence, and that's of course the basis of all philosophy and all religion, is to interpret existence. Now, we find two factors. We find what we might call, roughly, the factor of change, of motion, of flow. Nothing remains the same. That is what the Buddhists call samsara, the wheel of birth and death, the constant wheel of success, failure, success, love, hate, and so on. All sorts of opposites constantly blending into each other. A bewildering, unknowable confusion of events which happens more or less of themselves, it seems. Now, that is one factor. But, nevertheless, when we are trying to abstract ourselves from it, separate a little of ourselves from it, become objective for it, we find that that motion, that activity, has rhythm. That means that it has order in sequence. Events occur in sequence, in an ordered sequence. We may not see that order at first. We don't see it usually. But the order is there. There are patterns also, patterns of relationship. Things don't happen as haphazard. People don't meet one another as haphazard. Things don't go toward the other things as haphazard. There is a definite adjustment of parts to a whole. And that adjustment in functional interaction is the essence of what we call beauty. Now, all religion, all philosophy are essential and attempt to integrate those two things, the fact of complete change, constant unpredictability, and the fact of order, rhythm, harmony. One says there is only change and there is no order. Others say order only counts, the change is merely incidental and doesn't mean anything, you see. One will tell you have to go to order, the other one say you have to incarnate the order down into the change. You can look at it from all sorts of ways. But the moment you are taking those two factors of existence, inherent in existence, as if they were completely different factors, you see, which are not related the one to, well, they are related to one another, but they are definitely separated the one from another. You see. Then you get into the problem of duality. Then you get into the problem of why there is two things. If you speak of that divine order as the creator, then and this creator is all perfect, perfect harmony, perfect peace, perfect power, and so on. Then why is there chaos? Then you may say, well, something went wrong. You see, man sinned, and so on. Or you may take whatever you want. The only point is this, that why is there sin? Why is there evil? Why is there enough? And you can never find any solution, any answer, which really makes sense, however much you may try, metaphysically. And everybody has tried, and there have been one solution after another, in whether it is in Asia or in Europe. The moment you postulate the duality of the real and the unreal, the good and the bad, the divine and the human, as the creator and the creature, as two completely different realms of being and becoming, of divine existence and dark, natural, chaotic existence. The moment you do that, you are in an insoluble situation. And it is very, indeed, very strange that people do not realize, they do realize it, of course, the philosophers do realize it, but they still try to escape out of it sometimes by creating an evasion from both. Like the popular idea of nirvana, you realize the two are there, you are detached from either, and then you escape into something which is neither. But the problem is still remain there. Then if there is that realm of unity which is no longer really unity, why is there duality? In other words, you still come back to the same situation. If you escape from something, why was there something to escape from? Where did it come from? Now, the only thing, to my mind, that you can really work with is the idea that in that principle of duality you have missed a factor, an integrating factor, and that factor is what I would call the cycle. Because the concept of cycle enables you to see that there may be levels of existence, that there may be phases of existence within a cyclic pattern, but that it is still one existence. You may be at the beginning of the cycle, or at the middle of the cycle, or at the end of the cycle. You will have different consciousness. You may be able, if you are part of a larger cycle, to look at the smaller cycle as a unit immediately at once. If your cycle is I'm too literal there. If it's a cycle of million years, you live a million years. A year of human life, you see, is just like a second like that. Well, from your human point of view of a year, that man who sees your life as a second is timeless. His consciousness is timeless. Because he perceives it like that. What takes you a whole life to live, he sees it like that in the concentration of a minute or a second. And therefore, there is no... You have the idea also that a cycle, as we will see more in a practical sense when we deal next week, a cycle has a beginning and has an end. It starts from unity and it ends... It develops into multiplicity, and it ends into what I call multi-unity, that is to say, an integration of all the multiplicity, which, in a certain sense, is the perfect actualization of what was potential at the beginning of the cycle. The seed at the beginning of the spring, you see, contained in potentiality the whole plant. There is a multiplicity of function in that plant, and at the end, in a certain sense, it is not the example isn't perfect, but still, at the end of the year, you see that there is a new harvest, which in a multitude of seeds represent, reproduce, actualize what was potential, or the tree in full bloom, if you want, actualize in perfection the things which were potential in the seed. But the person who would be able to see the whole pattern, let's put it to take a picture, of the, you know, as you have a like motion picture put into one unit, you might say, of the seed plant seed. would see the cycle as a whole. Everything would fulfill its place within that cycle interplay. You have there perfect order. Now the plant which is eaten by a caterpillar may send itself into a terrible chaos, you see. But because it has no conception, the leaf, I mean, which is being eaten up, you see, has no conception of the whole plant and of the seed or anything like that. But still the thing is there. You see, you have what I call the aeonic consciousness, aeon, the cycle. You have part consciousness and aeonic consciousness. You have the consciousness which is completely identified with that little part of that small cycle, and the consciousness which is able to see the cycle as a whole, because it partakes of a larger cycle itself. You see. Now, if I, who am in a smaller cycle, have reached a point, perhaps toward the end of the cycle, where I can tune up, as it were, I can imagine, I can conceive, and I can feel to some extent, and I can attune myself to the larger cycle, to the field of activity of that larger cycle. Then my consciousness may reflect the consciousness of, call it a being, but it's not a being, it's a field more, you know, in which, for which my whole life is this little incident. And it's seen all at once. Now, therefore, the people who tell you that you have to escape from time into timelessness, which is the mystical approach and so on, Zen approach and all that, to me, miss the point. Because they do not see that what they call timelessness is still time, but it is time in terms of a, as it appears, in terms of a, the time of our cycle, as it appears to a larger cycle. You see. It is therefore the question of the problem is to attune yourself to the larger cycle consciousness so that you can reflect and eventually perhaps enter that field in which you can operate into that larger field. You see. Now, at first, of course, the first act of the human drama, you might say, is that we are purely identified with the cycle as an animal, as instinctual creature. We do the things that we have to do. We are like a primitive man, just operating like a tiger or a cat or a whatever animal does, you see, in terms of its human nature, which is completely adjusted to the cycle, dies with it, is reborn with it, hibernates with it, reawakens with it, and so on. It is unconscious, and it is in a certain sense perfect. That is to say, it meets perfectly the condition of that particular moment and particular cycle. But it is a narrow cycle. It is a cycle which can be completely changed. And if a great change happens, like for instance a certain type of the glacial period and all that, then perhaps the whole thing blow up, right? Like the great dinosaurs and all that, when change of climate, they just die off in a few years or a few centuries, you see. But if you then try to detach yourself from that lesser cycle in consciousness so that you can begin to understand how it operates, that cycle, then you are separating yourself from it in order to learn what it is. And of course, then you get into all sorts of trouble. And that is the human way. It is what the mystics call the via negativa. You learn the truth by the opposite of the truth. You find out all what it is not. And therefore, you come to the conclusion of what it is. Or having found all the ways blocked, then you realize there is no way. You see. Some book in Zen which saying that Zen is the... is a dead end which is which ends all dead ends. In other words, another term Jung used that other things in terms of healing. He said a man is never healed except that he has come to a point where he can go any longer. Nothing in him can go anymore. And yet he goes on. Now, what is it that makes him go on? If you then begin to try to find out what it is that makes you go on when you can't go on any longer, then you have shifted your center from a small cycle to a larger cycle. Now, so that you have, you see, the first act, which is an unconscious adjustment to the cyclic order. The second act is a detachment from that order, a refusal to die with it, and therefore a condition of constant conflict. Then you have the third act, which more or less is an act according to tradition and all that, where consciousness, which belongs to a larger cycle, are trying to impress something of their consciousness to the being of the lesser cycle, us men. Then, unfortunately, follows a fourth act. Because then men who have become aware of some of those ideas, some of those concepts of the larger dimension, you might say, begin to realize how those concepts and those revelations, put it that way, can be used to become powerful in their own cycle. So they begin to use those revelations as a means for self-aggrandizement. And the typical way to do that is to say, for them to claim that there are two separate worlds, and that the people of the lesser world can never go onto the higher world unless they pass through them, because they alone have the truth. They alone have been chosen by the higher consciousness to impart the things to the lower consciousness. Then you have all the conflict that goes on between an order which is separated from existence, and yet which existence has to go up to, you see. But you can only go up to that order, that divine order, if you follow a very strict and separate and definite path, which somebody controls more or less, or somebody will teach you, you see. There, you see, you have the whole perversion of the cyclic idea. You have the perversion of the concept, the relationship between the higher or the greater and the lesser. And there you have the concept of fate, you have the concept of determinism, you have the concept of a karma, which is an external thing that you are born under, of a caste system which you are born in and you cannot leave because this is a natural order and it is so ordained by the gods, you see. The higher beings and so on like that. Any form, whether it is valuable or not valuable, obviously it is valuable at a certain time. It is valuable to force upon people of a low mental and emotional development a sense of order. Because they could not, in a way, you see, they could not integrate themselves into the realization of the larger order. So that order has to be made external to them, so that it can be enforced upon them, so that they can be told that this is the way to reach that order, you see, by fear, by worship, by moral sanctions and all sorts of things like that. And that is therefore where, when the cyclic idea becomes completely perverted, as you have it had a great deal in Asia and in India and so on, you see. And therefore where it begins to be a means to escape from existence, because you say, well, either, oh, I have time in my next life, or, well, I am at that phase of the cycle, I was born there, there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, and all those kind of things which present the universe in its cyclic pattern, yet limit bind you to that particular cycle in which you are born, in which your consciousness operates at the time. Now, then the fifth act begins, as it were, which is the drive towards the reintegration of the other world and this world. You see, of the world of idea, the world of order, the world of perfection, and this world of existence. And the key there, you see, is the element of love. Because you have to find a way by means of which the higher and the lesser can become one, can feel one. You have to be able to make the lesser imagine himself as the greater, as part of the greater, and you have to bring the greater in term, in a condition where it sees itself not only not separated on in the lesser, but realizing that anything that happened in the lesser is essential to its own greater values. Now, as far as we know, that sense of love, the way I have spoke of it, that integrating principle, you see, came about the time of the first century BC, and probably never before in the history of man, at least as far as we know. It came in India at the northern Buddhism, which then glorified the idea of the Bodhisattva, who swear that he will refuse nirvana, perfection, supreme consciousness, until every sentient creature in the world is saved, reached nirvana. In other words, which accept as an absolutely ineradicable fact the binding of the whole with every little part of that whole. I am the whole of the earth, let us say. But if that little worm suffers, I suffer. There is something wrong. I can be perfected. If there is a man who is sinned and who is persecuted somewhere in China or something like that, I cannot reach perfection. Man cannot reach perfection. Humanity cannot be perfected. So you have there that element, you see, of love, which alone can erase, as it were, the negative aspect of psychic activity, because it alone can break from the boundaries of the cycles and blend them, as it were, blend the greater with the lesser and the lesser with the greater, make the lesser realize that it's part of the greater, but there is no difference. It's inside of the greater, you see. In Christ, we live, move, and have our being, you see. Therefore, you can't escape it. You can only close your eyes to it. You can make a circumference around yourself, but you can't escape it. Therefore, that is the fact. Now, this can only happen. You can only realize if that Christ in which we live and our being, as it were, comes to us, becomes us, you see. In other words, as the greater becomes the smaller can become the greater, can not exactly become the greater, but can find itself, see itself, be itself in term of this participation in the greater. Now we can call that love. In term of mind, we can have often called it as holistic perception. That means to see things as wholes, as complete entities, you see. And you have there a type of mind which is not the mind that cogitates, the mind that intellectually thinks and analyzes, but the mind that sees. The real mind doesn't think. The real mind sees. It is the seer mind. It sees symbols which are the total situation. It doesn't analyze the part of there is a thing, this is it. And there is it, the thing is presented as a whole. And you see the meaning of the thing as a whole, where it belongs, where you are, where that thing stands. It is like that in a moment, instantaneous perception. So it is the mind that sees, not the mind that thinks, because think is always a duality of this or not, this is so, this is not so, you have Aristotelian logic and all those things like that. Now, another way of putting it, as I have put often in my books and so on, is that this is the real aesthetical type of perception as against the ethical. The moment you have ethics, you have a dualism of good and bad, of right and wrong, of true and false, you see, or the principle of excluded middle, where a thing cannot be both right and wrong. A thing cannot be in this place and another place at the same time. But that is wrong, you see, in a sense. That is to say, this is a binding thing, because you are dividing existence. When you see in a painting, you may say, well, you speak of lights and shadows, for instance. We speak very much even in psychology, of Jung psychology, the shadow. But the moment you speak of a light and a shadow, you are making a dualism. You are using a concept there. You see. It's an abstraction. Actually, what you see in a painting is not light and dark. You see colored surface. Some are more intense than others, some are more brilliant than others, some are darker than others, but it is never a matter of light or dark, you see, unless you have a black and white drawing. Now, take another point, which is a very good example, and which will lead us up to the real meaning of the whole thing. Take a dancer. When a dancer falls, she does not collapse. She meets the floor in order to rebound from it. Now, think of that. Try to think of that when you go home. A person falls because he's pushed and is like that. There is either standing or falling. He's either alive or dead. But the dancer, you see, is constantly in motion. It is doing something. It falls. It meets the floor. And out of that meeting, something happens. It rebounds, one way or another. And there we come to that thing, which is the essential question of the true existentialist. Is the realization that all life, all existence, is a series of meetings. That is the one central fact of all existence, meetings. And all what matters is how significant can you make your meetings? How much can you include in them? How much can you illumine by them? Now, this is the one thing that counts, nothing else counts. That is the one law. It is like an old tradition of society, old religion, morality, and so on, complicate existence. It is like when Jesus says, yes, follow the law, yes, follow the law, but there is only one law. As I love you. In other words, bring to every meeting that essential significance of the integration of the cyclic interplay of the lesser and the greater. Meet the other lesser in terms of the greater, in that which you can contribute to the wholeness of the greater, and which therefore will call from the greater a response where two or three meet, there I am, in my name, there I am. You see. Now, all those things which involve duality, good, bad, God and man, and all those things like that, are needed, of course, but they are needed at a certain time, purely as a pedagogical instrument. You have to teach something to some children, and you have to teach them certain practice, which of themselves they will have to forget. You see. But they have to be taught certain things as a start. You see. But essentially, all that is true is simple and significant. But of course, there are two kinds of simplicity. There is the simplicity which you find when you are fresh and pure and innocent, and everything is just fine, and you just flow into the world beautifully and so on. Then there is that simplicity which comes at the end, when you accept all relationships and all meetings, regardless of the possibility of being hurt by them, regardless of the fear that you might have of them. We are open to all meetings which carry promises of significance. In between, you have been hurt, and therefore everything becomes complicated, because you begin to fear everything. Everything poses problems, and so you come to somebody and ask them how to solve the problem, and the person gives you all sort of nice rules: don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, do this and this in such a way and not in any other way, mind you, and so on like that. And life becomes horribly complicated until you begin to realize that all that doesn't matter, provided that you are meeting everything with love and with the realization that every meeting must be significant and has a significance only if you can find it. Now, this is, as I say, the true existentialist. It is not dark, it is not desperate, proud, or it is not a kind of meek Kierkegaardian sense of creatureness, completely at the mercy of the God, which is mysterious, and the mystery, the irrational mystery, is the one thing that is at the base of everything. There is no need of that, you see. But the thing that all that is taken because, in that way, because it doesn't see that there is a larger cycle enfolding, unclosing, surrounding you. There is a pride of not wanting to see superior creature beyond you, you see. The idea of the things as masters and so on, of course, has been horribly materialized and made almost ridiculous by most people who speak about them. But nevertheless, it is curious to see psychologists like Jung and so on like that just simply biting with the hurt pride that there could be such creature above men, you know. And it would be very interesting if ever there are higher humanities or in other planets who come down to see us, and what will happen to men after their pride deflated like that. It may be the great crisis of the end of this century, you know. I mean, it's not necessary to have an atomic war. That kind of crisis might be just as devastating, at least to the mind. So that it is the existence can be an open, free, flowing, like Zen people want it. You are like flowing like the river. There is no boundary. You flow naturally, spontaneously in the now and so on. Yes, but you see, that now is not just an isolated thing, you see. You have to live in that now. You have to live in terms of the relationship, the meeting that comes there. But it is going somewhere, you see. It is going somewhere, and there is absolutely no sense that I can see why to refuse to see it going anywhere. The point I gain is a pedagogical thing, you see. People are so set in making plan and purpose. Now it's going to be exactly that way. I'm going to get married, and this is going to be that. We will have breakfast and this and this and so on like that. but if that is the kind of planning and purpose, so-called purpose, or the goal. I'm going to have a Cadillac in 4 years, and then we buy that mortgage things and so on. You know, I mean, the whole suburban life and also nice executive and so on. Well, of course, those kind of planning and purpose are relatively ridiculous, I mean, in terms of narrow pattern. You see, that, of course, people like Zen and so on try to break that down, you see. And you said, give up all that is bondage, all that leaves you nowhere. What is success? What is insuccess? And all those things like that, you see. But live in the moment and so on. But the point is that at the same time, you should be able to realize, you see, that this is part of a larger pattern, as part of a larger whole, and that there is that constant reaction between this lesser whole and you are and the larger one. And it meets the greater, meets the lesser at every point of space and time. And every point of space of time, to my mind, cease to have its full meaning if you don't see it in terms of that meeting. If you're just limited to that now, as your body can feel it, sense it, and all that immediately, narrowly, chemically, by vibration, you know, something like that. It is more than that. Of course, in a certain sense, from a divine point of view, a higher point of view, you might say that Christianity, of course, brought us the idea of the God-man, the man, the union of the human and the divine, and all that, which is a symbol of the coming down of the higher as the lower come down, and the point of merging, of which the transfiguration is the symbol, and there the two meet, and therefore the whole world is integrated and illumined, you see. And of course, this, of course, can also operate in terms of the very simplest and the very most fundamental meeting of all, which is the meeting of the man and the woman. Because there, you see, all types of experience are potential in that meeting. All the gamut of love is there, implied, potential. And no note is unessential. A cathedral has spires and beautiful rose windows and glowing walls moving up skyward, but it has also foundations dark in the earth, and if there were not for those foundations, there would be no spire and rose windows and beautiful Gothic walls, you see. And of course, sex can be the foundation of love, which includes all and which sees the meetings in terms of the totality of the personality and not merely in terms of some ideal pattern or ideal image of what the person is or the other person is. But the question, of course, is what kind of sex? There are harsh, brutal, excited, passional kind of sex, or it can be very gentle in its intensity and very peaceful in its dynamism and resolving fire into light, illumining everything it touches. Now today, if there is, for instance, if there is a great deal or so much insistence upon sex and revelation about everything dealing with it, let's use that symbol that I speak of, the cathedral. It is because the outer building of love, the spires, the rose windows and all that, have been shattered, or because the foundation on which they were built was so hypocritical and so unsteady and uncertain that, of course, they collapsed of their own weight. And so when when you are in a bombed city, you have to take refuge in the open foundation. There is nothing else in which you can take refuge. But also one doesn't need to build great edifices of matter. One may live in tents, you may live in forests like yogis, you may have the whole of nature as your foundation. And if you can have meetings on such foundations, they can be indeed immensely beautiful, filled with stars, glowing with sunset and brilliant dawns. And then, you see, man can be truly free in that existential freedom which leaves nothing out, because it includes potentially everything. And this existence can be really poems or motets of ever-changing, ever-renewed experiencing. Yet they can be rhythmic, they can be ordered, they can be beautiful. And in those poems, death and life can always and must always be seen as complementing each other. not to be overcome or escaped from, but to be fulfilled every day, in every meeting and in every love. And it should be fulfilled in beauty, in significance, and in peace. And they can be fulfilled if the essential sense of fulfillment in you emerges from the fact that you are at every moment realizing that you are part of a cycle, which itself is part of a larger cycle. You are part of a universe, which is little universe, which is part of a larger universe. And that the little and the large are constantly related at every point. And there is only one thing that reaches through the whole universe, and it is that element of, call it love if you want, which tends to have everything full. The plenitude of everything, the plenitude of space, the plenitude of relationship, the plenitude of meetings. And it is only through the expression of that plenitude that you can have really the fulfillment of existence. Thank you.
This is the end of The Philosophy of Cyclic Activity by Dane Rudjar. The preceding audio is copyrighted by Leila Rudjar Hill and was brought to you by Rita, the Rudjar Institute for Transpersonal Activity. Learn more about Rita or contribute to the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudjar at www.rudjarinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudjar, visit www.rudjaraudioarchives.com.